Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Got an email, huh, Gabe?
Gentlemen, love the subjects, the tone, the curiosity, and the obvious friendship between you.
Who's saying this?
Sherry. I am a 68-year-old woman who would call myself an atheistic, agnostic optimist. She is writing with regard to the end of the world. We talked last week about how a third of Americans, national surveys, think that the world is going to end in their time while they're alive.
Right. So within, let's say, your life for a maximum of like another 70 years, let's say, hopefully, you think that in that time period, this Earth is going to end, and hence that dramatically changes how you would approach fixing things on this planet, politically or socially.
With reference to that, Sherry says, basically hedging my bets, I have always said that if there was a nuclear war, I would run toward the light as I have no transferable skills of value in a post-apocalyptic world. I hate camping in any form. The end of the world, quote, as we know it, I believe is coming. And frankly, we deserve it.
Ah, okay.
Whatever form it takes. Will Earth die? No. You mentioned how clever crows are, and I would add primates, dolphins, elephants, and a myriad other species fully capable of restoring the Earth to a place of value. Right now, it is being cheapened and exploited by greed, pettiness, and short-sightedness. If by some miracle we do pull back from the brink, then perhaps kindness, generosity, and compassion will become the virus of the day and infect the world. A girl can dream, Sherry.
Wow. Okay. Two things. The Raven reference was connected or in connection with research we talked about last week from Yellowstone National Park in the United States that ravens don't follow wolves. They know where wolves probably hunt. And so they fly to those spots sometimes to look, is there any meat? That was that reference there. The other thing that has to be said is that is a misanthropic worldview. The idea that humans are destructive and should be gone. And that there's a utopic aftermath to that, right? That the animals would live freely and better without us.
Yeah.
And that is also connected to the research. That's one of the non-religious, the world is going to end viewpoints that also affects how you would approach fixing things or not fixing things. If you believe that, you know, our destruction would mean everything's better versus our destruction is everything's worse, it changes how you're going to react.
In any event, how you view whether or not the world is going to end in your lifetime, it has an effect on how you see the world, and it is shaped by how you see the world. They're all interlinked. Sherry, thank you very much for sharing your misanthropic worldview.
And one of the things we said in connection with that research, I believe, is that your perception of what's happening in the world or whether the world's in a good spot may be connected to your usage of media, specifically social media. Just going to mention what is the word landmark court case gets thrown around quite a bit, and I think this actually is one. And that's why I'm going to mention it again in case some of you out there missed it. This was based in Los Angeles, where a court or a jury ruled that a 20-year-old woman, her name is Kaylee, should receive $6 million in damages from two major social media companies or media companies. This is Meta, the company that owns Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Google, specifically YouTube. And what they ruled there is that these two companies, specifically on the platforms of Instagram and YouTube, they quote unquote acted with malice, oppression, or fraud, and that led to the social media addiction of this now woman. She's talking about how she got addicted to YouTube at age 6. I think at age 9 or 10, Instagram, it led to her using all these filters to change the way she looked, and that developed into body dysmorphia. Now, the companies themselves, I'm going to quote Meta here, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says, quote, teen mental health is profoundly complex and cannot be linked to a single app. Now, the interesting part here, the reason I think that this is an actual landmark case that will change the course of social media in the future is that you don't have to prove that part necessarily. So I think a lot of you out there are or will remember another landmark case about addiction. This was against Philip Morris and 8 other cigarette manufacturers together. A long, massive case, very complex. But all that they really had to prove, it wasn't about consumer behavior necessarily. It was what the companies knew about addiction and what they marketed and how they marketed it, and then also the evidence that they destroyed. So if they'd done research showing that nicotine, for example, is addictive, and they knew that and destroyed that evidence, all of these formed a larger picture of an attempt to fraudulently delude the public. And that was ruled against those companies ultimately. And this is kind of seen or being viewed as the opening salvo in a number of court cases, because this will be appealed, that attempt to show that social media companies were aware of the addictive properties of some of their platforms and that they intentionally dialed those up to increase addiction, knowing what will do it, and then an intent to deceive people about that.
There's a the study that I want to talk to you today about, Connor, and to our listeners, also has a news peg in court in Pennsylvania. A judge gave community service to two juveniles, adolescents. They're, I think, 16 or 17 years old at this point. Those two kids admitted to using deepfake, essentially AI technology, to create and share deepfake sexual imagery about 59 girls at their public or private school, Lancaster Country Day School in Pennsylvania. They admitted to doing that, and they were given community service. This is the first time that minors have been punished legally for using deepfake sexual imagery against girls.
And just to jump in real quickly, for those of you who don't really understand this strange sounding combination of words we've just used, they're basically these platforms we were just talking about, Instagram, to take one example. There may be a student whose picture is up there, and these pictures are then downloaded, and with AI software, they are manipulated and attached to a sexualized body in some form. Now, it's not obviously the real body of the person.
These kids, this is what they admitted to. They found pictures of these 59 girls on either Instagram, TikTok, or FaceTime, used those faces together with these apps that you can download. We're not going to talk about those. I looked into it. It's incredible how many users these things have and how easy and how accessible this technology is. All you need is a picture of someone, and you can turn that into anything you want. These kids did this, admitted to it, and shared it at this school. And again, we're talking about 59 girls. Many of them had to transfer schools. The trauma of this, of having this imagery created and shared about them, was too much for them to handle. And this proceedings like this in Pennsylvania, normally they're closed. The judge in this particular case decided to open them up to the community because he wanted people to see these boys apologize. And he asked them four different times, "Do you want to say something to these people whose lives
you've demolished?
You've kind of ruined." They shut their mouth. And one of the parents, they spoke, and some of the kids, some of the girls themselves spoke. And one girl said, "Why would they do this? Why would you do this? You took my innocence from me." And they had no response to that. And the study that I wanted to talk to you today about, Connor, looked into this. Motivations. Why would you do this? It was a study out of Australia, Monash University in Australia. They interviewed perpetrators, people or men or boys who have used this deepfake technology against girls or women. Why did they do it? And what the researchers were shocked by. So there were a few of the men who said that they got a kind of godlike feeling of power, control or dominance over women. But the real takeaway was that most of them thought it was just kind of a joke. They were just fooling around, and that they apparently weren't aware of the harm that it causes. Some of them said, it's just a picture. I'm not hurting anyone by doing this. It's just funny. I'm just creating this. I'm curious. I'm just creating this stuff, sharing it with my friends, and we're having a laugh. The study, the researchers also interviewed victims, so 15 victims, and they also described, like in Pennsylvania, having their life ruined, reputations destroyed, not wanting to be seen in public, deep psychological distress, humiliation, this kind of thing. So you've got this unbelievable disconnect between the perpetrators who are doing this, creating it and sharing this stuff, who apparently aren't aware at all, and then on the other side, people who are having their life ruined. So what is going on? there.
Right. And obviously, one thing to address there is the caveat that these are the words they're saying, and that there may be a kind of moral disconnect.
Yeah, like a moral disengagement. By saying it's just a joke, maybe you're just telling yourself that you're just fooling around because you, deep down, you are aware of how harmful it is. But by saying that, it's kind of a way to get rid of that cognitive dissonance or that sense of responsibility or accountability. By saying it's just a joke, then you're not doing anything wrong. But whether it's that or that they... Actually, even more problematic would be to be unaware.
Well, because of the ease of technological access, it's an app that's downloaded, an image that's downloaded, up to the app, click. You're about four clicks away from what to them feels like an innocent joke. They say it's that. I don't know if it's actually that, but they say it's that. And if that is the case, then yeah, there's an enormous gap between what they think they're doing and the consequences of doing it.
The researchers in Australia said that is the point of their study. I mean, we're at the beginning. This is the first of its kind, actually trying to get into the minds of these people and why they're doing this. What they said has to be done at this point is to fix this awareness gap. How do you educate or communicate to people how harmful this stuff is? That is where the work has to be done. And if people are listening to this right now, if you encounter this or somebody threatens you with imagery like this, there is a global organization called StopNCII.org. That's non-consensual intimate imagery, StopNCII.org. It's in 38 languages. It's online. You can report. There's a step-by-step process that they offer you for support, what to do. That's a start. Legal frameworks worldwide, in every country, there's a different legal framework. And in many instances, from state to state, within that country, it's different. There's different legal frameworks for adults, for minors. You cannot keep up with the technological advancements.
Yeah. Well, and that website is one first resource. It is global. And the other, and now we're kind of shooting from the hip or just going from our personal opinion here. But for all the guys out there, who it may be as simple as somebody turning their phone to you, talking maybe to the young guys here, and they show, hey, look, haha, it's someone we both know, ha, and I've used AI to make her, or to sexualize her image, kind of. It is very, very hard to tell a friend they've done something morally wrong. That is a hard thing to do, and yet I think one way, maybe, would be to take it back into the real world. Like, in the real world, you would never walk up to someone and pull off a shirt. You would never do that because that is sexual assault, and you know that. And what we're looking at here in that case, if it happens, is the virtual equivalent of sexual assault, and it needs to be at least thought about that way, in that way, for I think people to begin to understand how egregiously harmful and disruptive and destructive this is for women, because unfortunately, the technological ease has somewhat caused it to feel too harmless to some specific people.
Yeah, and I got three girls at home. Ava right now is about to turn 14. Lynn's 10. Heidi's 7. I don't even want to go there if this were to happen to one of them. Like, those parents in that court in Pennsylvania, I don't even know what,
That's the question for all of you out there. How do we collectively not go there any further than we are right now? Let us know. We're su@dw.com. I think most of our listeners all around the world, you're aware of the fact that if you go out in nature and you hear animals, that they have various calls, right? It's not just one call that they can do all the time. You have birds that can sing a variety of songs. You have, I'm just going to take deer off the top of my head, that can make a variety of sounds, and all sorts of other animals that can do different pitch, tone, length.
Yeah. And when we hear those sounds, we almost have an automatic response inside of us. Do we like that sound? Or do we not?
And there's new research that has looked into that to figure out to what extent do our preferences line up with animals. And I thought the conclusion was kind of surprising.
Science Unscripted.
My name is Logan James. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at McGill University, as well as UT Austin, and I just published a paper on sound preferences in animals.
Logan, what would you say is the primary conclusion of the paper you just published?
Yeah, so we looked at preferences that animals have for different sounds, and we used those sound preferences in a study that we actually conducted on humans, where we asked humans which sounds they preferred, and we found that the humans tended to prefer the same sounds that other animals preferred.
We like the sounds that animals like, usually. That's
what we found, yeah.
All right. So you were nice enough, Logan, to send me some of those sounds. We're going to cue them up right here. Gabe, you haven't heard any of these.
No, I have not.
And we're going to go through some of the animal sounds. And the idea here is to see whether, well, first and foremost, which sound you like and which sound you don't like, Gabe. We're going to become part of the experiment here. And you're going
to... Are you going to do it too?
Well, I kind of know the answers. Yeah. So that wouldn't be a really good test. You don't.
Oh, so you're prejudiced. Okay. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And just to be clear here, we're going to hear one sound twice, and then I'm going to pop in, and then we're going to hear another sound twice. And this sound here that you're about to hear is from a song sparrow. And the question, Gabe, is whether you find that sound more attractive or less attractive than this one.
I found the first sound less attractive than the second.
The first sound of that song sparrow was less attractive than the second?
Yes. The second one was more attractive, yeah.
And Logan, I don't know how familiar you still are with these sounds. I know you did this work a little while ago, but is Gabe correct? Is he in line with most human beings or not?
He is correct. He's in line with both the majority of the participants in our study, as well as the song sparrows themselves.
Okay, we're going to move on to sound number two. And what I found interesting about your study, you looked at how many animals total?
16 different species.
Okay, and what I had expected, I don't know why, when I saw the headline or the conclusion, I thought, oh, these must be animals that are very similar to us human beings, probably primates or, I don't know, monkeys, right? And
yeah.
We are now going to move from song sparrows, Gabe, to Pacific field crickets.
I found the first sound way more attractive.
Really?
Than the second, yeah.
Huh. The first of those sounds?
Yes.
And Logan, where does Gabe stand in regard to the rest of humanity?
Well, in this case, he is not like the rest of humanity, nor is he like the crickets. But, you know, that's a great two. There's no preference was ever completely 100%. So we got to find those people out there.
I can understand where those people and crickets are coming from. The second one was softer and lighter and possibly more pleasant, but I liked the deafening driving. What is the sound that a cricket makes? What is the vocabulary word for that?
The first one, they actually call it a purr. And normally it is actually quieter than the second one. But in this case, for the study, we made them all the similar amplitude just for logistical and, you know, for various reasons. But yeah. But you know, a purr can be a nice sound too. So I don't think you're crazy or anything.
Thank you, Logan. Before we go on to sound number three, how did you ascertain what crickets or song sparrows what sound they found agreeable? How did you find that out?
Yeah, it's a great question. So this comes from a lot of previous research. So the most common way we do this is simply with speakers and what we call phonotaxis, which is just a fancy way of saying movement towards sound. Mm. And so you play a sound from a speaker and you see if the animal moves towards it. Usually we do this in a really similar way with a study where we have two options. We have two speakers, they alternate playing different sounds, and then we watch to see where the animal goes. Does she hop towards, you know, one side if it's a of the chamber. I'm talking about frogs. That's my what I'm used to studying. Or does she go to the other side of the chamber where to tell us which sound she likes?
This would be like humans walking through a mall and choosing the clothing store based on music, right? I would definitely drift toward
100%.
The one, yeah, the one that has good music and not the one that has music that I hate. Okay, we're going to move to, speaking, you just mentioned frogs there. We're going to move to the hourglass tree frog. I'm going to play it twice again. Is it more or less attractive than the second sound that I play twice? That was the first one.
Well, I didn't like either of them. They remind me of my alarm clock, but I would, if I have to answer, I would say the first sound was more pleasant.
Yeah, and probably very difficult to define why.
It had a different cadence.
And Logan, there's a term for that first da 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 or something.
Yeah, so you're exactly right that both the frogs and the humans tended to like that first one better. And this is a case of what we call acoustic adornments. So it's just as simple, it's as simple as just adding a little bit of extra something to the sound. So that first one, we call them, you know, these clicks. So it has a longer click, then it adds a series of sort of shorter clicks to the end of it. Whereas in the first one, it's just that kind of baseline long click sound. And so this is just, an example of adding a little bit of sound makes it a bit more attractive to both the humans and the other animals. And this was pretty consistent across other stimuli in the data set.
And less aggressive, now that you say that.
Yeah.
When I try to almost never honk my horn, ever, like the horn of my car, because I just, it's so loud, it's so disruptive. But if somebody ahead of me is, like, the lights turn green, and they're not going, and they're looking probably at their phone, right? And the light's turning, still green, you have to honk at some point.
I wait for the person behind me to honk.
No. what I've realized, and I've never had any logic for this, is I don't... Doing it once seems aggressive, but if I do beep beep or beep 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 beep, right? That's not aggressive. For some reason, what is the acoustic law?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly, but yeah, I mean, I agree that there's something about the sort of the pauses and the cadence that can kind of signal that there's less intensity to it. I mean, I agree with that.
Yeah, especially the way you do it too. Like, I'm sorry, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you got to go, man.
Yeah, I'm about to miss my green light. And this is my life we're talking about here. Okay, we're going to go on to our final example here. We're going to return to the birds that we started with. Not the same birds. This is the zebra finch. And now sound number two.
No doubt sound number one more agreeable. I could understand it better. I could feel it better. The second one was more of a cacophony. The rhythm that the first one had, the second one just didn't.
And I believe, Logan, other human beings, our listeners out there right now, agree with Gabe.
They do indeed.
But
they don't agree with the zebra finch that produced those sounds. So for the zebra finch, that second one was perfect. And the first one was strange.
Wow.
What causes that difference to happen?
Yeah, so this is, you know, the study we found a huge range in preference. So we find this overall effect that humans agree, but there are plenty of exceptions to that. And this is one of the stronger exceptions, is that we don't agree with the zebra finch in this case. And, you know, I could speculate for a variety of reasons why that might be the case, but it's hard to really know for sure. But I do find that these exceptions are exciting and interesting because they kind of lead us to some new questions about what is it about these sounds that the zebra finches are latching onto that we just really are not.
And what your research is aimed at, what exactly? What are you trying to figure out by comparing how animals and human beings perceive sound?
Yeah, there's a couple angles to it. I mean, one of it is just trying to understand where the biases and predispositions in our sensory systems come from. So the way we perceive the world is, you know, based in some of the same fundamentals as the way that other animals perceive the world because of how we're related to each other. And so getting a sense of sort of where all that comes from, I think, is useful for moving forward into figuring out, you know, why do we like some sounds over others? We really don't have good answers for that right now. I think this kind of research is leading us into some new and exciting directions.
I know that one of the big questions that SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence deals with is how would species or life forms, intelligent forms, how would they communicate with each other if they had no idea what the other's language is or how they communicate? Are you working toward, I don't have a term for it, but something like a universal acoustic truth that if all animals, including us, no matter when we branched off, like something in a certain pattern or order, even if we have different ears, different ways of perceiving that sound, that there may be universal acoustic truths that appeal everywhere, all across the universe.
I mean, I love the sentiment. I think the reality is that like there is not going to be something universal because each species has their weird quirks and specificities that they evolve that bring them in totally different directions. And so thinking about those, you know, those primates, those geladas that are similar to us, but then have really different, you know, opinions. I think we're really looking at these sort of fundamental baselines that species kind of build on with their own worlds and, you know, their own acoustic processing and all that kind of thing. And, you know, the way that animals perceive these sounds, it's completely different from the way we perceive them. So the fact that we even have any similar preferences is pretty astounding to me. The way that I'm sort of viewing this more broadly is sort of just a reminder for myself when I'm out in nature that, you know, I think about the songs of birds or the colors of butterflies or the smells of flowers. And these are all things that are meant to attract other animals, but they are not meant to attract me. They're not for humans. But yet I think because we share some of these fundamental processing biases with other animals, we get to enjoy that same beauty as well.
And that was Logan James, a postdoctoral fellow at McGill University in Canada. He's also affiliated with the University of Texas, Austin, and Yale University in the United States.
Speaking to us there from Montreal, we have a lot of people who spend time in nature based on the emails that you guys send us on a regular basis. Thank you so much for that. I'm wondering, for the people who do spend a lot of time in nature with animals, what are your examples of animals that apparently perceive sound the way you do?
You think that our listeners would know that?
Maybe.
How would they know that?
Mark, let's say Mark.
Mark lives in the rainforest.
What if there are sounds that happen when Mark's outside and he's surrounded by animals and they run off and he happens to sound?
Yeah, then you could perceive it if they move away, if you see them.
If they
move
run away, because that's how they did this experiment.
I see what you're saying.
That's how they did the experiment.
Yeah.
Sound happens. They run away if they don't like it. If you happen to like that sound, what?
Yeah. What I thought you were going to say is the sounds out in the, I mean, nature, right? We're all aware of how lovely it is and how calming. We've talked on the show a lot about how it can reduce cortisol levels, just even a few minutes.
Birdsong in particular.
Yeah. And even virtual versions of those natural settings can do the same for you if you don't have access to them.
Very important point. Yeah.
But I was kind of latching on the idea of the ugly sounds. We don't have them back where I grew up, but the European jay is a bird, very prominent. Its plumage is lovely, and it belies its ugly call. Mm-hmm. Ah, it's just this. It's this awful sound, and apparently to other jays, I'm guessing that it's a nice sound. It's one of the most common sounds. What are your least favorite animal sounds out in the wild? And then also, if you don't want to focus on the negative, what are your favorites?
Or how about, expand it to outside of the animal kingdom. What are your favorite sounds in general? Or what sounds do you truly hate?
Probably not the honking of a horn is on the list of favorites. Anyway, let us know what you're thinking. SU@DW.com.
Science Unscripted.
I want to be in the quiet zone. Want to be here on my own. Want to see what I can do. But I don't know what I'd be if you where to go. Maybe it would be just fine. Ring the bell and the bell would chime. I could fly somewhere, but I don't know what I'd be if you were to go.
DW, made for minds.